I'm standing above a glacier that's the source of one of the most revered and economically important rivers on Earth. You've heard of the Ganges River. It sustains hundreds of millions of people. Even more consider the river sacred. But the glacier is in trouble, and so are glaciers much closer to you, in Montana, for instance. Our story's about glaciers, but most of all, it's about what happens to people when that ice melts away. I've come high into the Himalayas to explore global warming and its effect on ice, water, food, and the fate of our world with a famous explorer in his own right. Along with me for this journey is Conrad Anker, veteran of many Everest, Antarctic, and Himalayan mountaineering expeditions. Our special report on thin ice was produced by William Campbell.
Breathing the tack-sharp air in a high-altitude meadow at the foot of Shivling, the Matterhorn of India, it's easy to feel removed from the commotion of the world below. No cars up here, no roads, no electricity, and very few people. Just a handful of religious pilgrims, a distant base camp of climbers, and our small team from PBS, led by Conrad Anker, the mountaineer and environmentalist. The plan is to check out the endangered Gangotri Glacier at the headwaters of the Ganges and to witness what we hear is an environmental calamity in the making, one that could foretell an unimaginable future for the world as we know it.
The Ganges and the Gangotri Glacier, in a way, is a story between the land and the sky, between the air and the soil. And that story that you're telling through your travel there, I think tells so much, because what we do on the land ends up devastating the climate.
The snow that falls here in the Himalayas compacts into glaciers, literally rivers of ice that are constantly changing and moving. New snow falls on top and turns to ice. Out the business end of the glacier, melting ice becomes a nice river of fresh water. This is how many of the great rivers of Asia begin. Glaciers serving as water storage towers, which keeps the flow of water going even during the otherwise dry parts of the year. And that's when everything is going well. Though we may tread lightly on this fragile landscape, the world at large has not been so gentle with the high mountain ice. According to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, global warming, caused by the burning of fossil fuels, is melting glaciers almost everywhere. At a big gathering of experts in Denmark just last month, scientists warned that the process is accelerating even faster than most recent predictions. They say melting ice may raise sea levels more than 3 feet by the end of this century. And a G8 report leaked to the media just last week warned that global warming may soon trigger a worldwide food crisis that would threaten international security. The most vivid way to measure how quickly we're heating up is to check out the world's melting glaciers. Even the ones near you are going fast. In Montana's Glacier National Park, the ice will likely disappear in just over a decade.
The year 2020 will be when our glaciers are gone or virtually gone, unless we have some change in the rate at which the temperatures are increasing. Our glaciers are doing exactly what glaciers are doing in Switzerland, in the Himalayas, in South America, many of them in Alaska and Canada.
In a way, we are all treading on thin ice. Not only do glaciers illustrate the story of global warming, but what happens in these breathtaking ice-capped mountains is vitally important to the future of our civilization. You've probably already heard about how these shrinking ice sheets are affecting the lives of penguins and polar bears. But have you considered the connection between the Himalayan glaciers and the loaf of bread on your table?
What happens to India's wheat harvest and its rice harvest will affect not only India, but it'll affect food prices throughout the world.
Farmers in Asia rely heavily on irrigation from rivers. And during the annual dry season, melting glaciers supply up to 70% of the water in rivers like the Ganges. Right now, more than 500 million people in India depend on the Ganges for drinking water and crop irrigation. If there's not enough consistent water flow, and India can no longer produce enough wheat, rice, and soy to feed its people, it will have to rely on imports. Economists say that will drive up prices and cause food shortages worldwide. We have already seen a glimpse of the future 300 miles south of here as Delhi's mushrooming population outpaces its water supply. Some neighborhoods have no tap water at all.
The really water wars happening right now. It's happening in Delhi, where people queue up for hours for a water tanker. If the water tanker doesn't have enough water, a conflict. In Gujarat, I know of cases where brother has killed brother over scarcity of water.
Every morning, trucks collect water from government water towers and deliver it to dry areas around Delhi. Look at this scene. Folks have to bring their own hoses and scramble to siphon off their share. You can't live without it, and sometimes riots erupt if there's not enough water to go around. If the planet keeps heating up, the same water shortages and crop failures could happen on the other side of the Himalayas, where disappearing glaciers also threaten the health of the rivers in China. It's crucial to know what's going on up here on the roof of the world, but because these distant ice fields are hard to reach, they're also hard to monitor. Climate scientists may rely on remote imagery, but to really understand the human story that connects us to the fate of the ice, I needed to go beyond satellite pictures taken from 22,000 miles up and arrange a first-hand encounter with the glacier that feeds the sacred Ganges River. That's something that requires prep. So we begin this journey in Montana, the home state of Conrad Anker, a man who has spent his career on ice.
I'm a climber. And specifically, I'm an alpinist. That means I climb tall, snowy, ice-clad mountains. I've been doing it now for 25, 30 years. That's what I love to do. But what I'm seeing in the mountains is a change in the mountain environment, a change in the climate. Being an experienced climber, I have to be in tune with the medium I'm climbing on. I'm seeing in places that had glaciers 20 years ago, these glaciers have receded quite dramatically. When we go up to repeat a route that was first climbed in, say, 1985, climbing it 20 years later, the ice line is up 3,000 feet.
Conrad has climbed to the top of Mount Everest twice and a decade ago solved one of mountaineering's big mysteries. He discovered the frozen body of George Mallory, a legendary climber who vanished in 1924 while trying to be the first to reach the summit of Everest. Mallory was the guy with the famous comeback. When asked why climb the world's tallest mountain, he said, because it is there. Oh. Conrad Anker has a more complex relationship with mountains. Accidents and weather have claimed many of his climbing buddies, including his best friend, Alex Lowe. Just months after the Mallory expedition, Conrad, Alex, and photographer David Bridges were walking along a Tibetan glacier when they were caught in an avalanche. Conrad ran one way, David and Alex another. David and Alex were killed when they were swept away and buried under the ice and snow. Conrad was battered and badly shaken. The devastating loss whipsawed Conrad's life in a new direction. In their shared grief, Conrad and Alex Lowe's widow, Jenny, an artist and author, grew closer.
Oh, it's nice to see it in the window.
Yeah.
With all the other women authors.
They fell in love and married. Conrad moved to Bozeman, Montana, and became a father to Alex and Jenny's three young sons.
It was sort of a pivotal point in my life, and it was something that happened on a glacier. I realized that glaciers and being on mountains were my passion, but it was in a selfish pursuit of adventure. And then I realized afterwards there was more to life than climbing mountains and having this adventure up there. My perspective on life went from the world at my fingertips and what served me to the bigger picture that I was here for other people. And by extension, that came to include glaciers. And they were a place that I loved being. But I also saw the importance that these natural reservoirs of water had for humans. They held water, and water gives life. And when you realize how precious life is, then all things that give life have more value.
It would have been.
Conrad still climbs the highest peaks, but his mission is more focused, given his acute appreciation of the slim margins of survival in the high mountains. In this way, Conrad has a special feel for the precarious condition of the planet, where our collective survival could hinge on a few degrees of temperature. While Conrad has been swinging his axe into the melting ice and sounding the alarm about warming based on skilled observation, ecologists like Dr. Daniel Fagry of the U.S. Geological Survey in Montana back up his observations with solid scientific data. If you have any doubt about glaciers shrinking, check out Dr. Fagry's computer model of Glacier National Park.
This is Blackfoot and Jackson Glacier in the white, and so the white represents where the glaciers were, say, in 1900, 1910. And you can see that decade by decade, the glacier's retreating. And this is all historical information. This has already happened. But we take all the information from this and make a geospatial model and look in the future, like right there in 2030, when the glaciers disappear entirely.
But the problem isn't just vanishing glaciers in a single national park. It's how changing weather patterns are threatening the snowpack in mountains throughout the West.
We've had about a 1.6 degree centigrade temperature increase, which is quite a bit above the global average. And in fact, the Rocky Mountains as a whole have experienced almost twice the global average temperature increase. So mountains are particularly vulnerable. And this is important, I think, because 50% of the water that we have as humans to use for irrigation, for drinking, comes indirectly or directly from mountains. And in the arid West, it's about 85%. So humans are very tied to mountains. Mountains are very vulnerable to climate change, and that's manifested mostly in the temperature increases.
I visited Conrad at his home in Montana, hoping he could teach me the language of ice and what it's saying to us. My friends see me as a bit of a gearhead, but this, I had to say, was impressive.
This is an ice screw, and this is what we use for protection. As we go out, we'll be putting these in.
Against my better judgment, I asked him for an ice climbing lesson. After a safety briefing, Conrad and some of his climbing buddies took me up to a snowy place called Highlight Canyon in the mountains a few miles south of Bozeman. Not only is it a favorite spot for ice climbers, it's the main watershed for the valley below.
Look at this. Like some sort of frozen pipe organ from an outdoor cathedral.
And with your feet, imagine if you're punting a football, you get a good purchase to it.
I've got to say, it is at the outer edge of David Brancaccio's envelope, and I'm certainly appreciative of all your skill in reading ice, because if I was not with a master, I'd be really quite concerned.
Yeah, and you've got 11 millimeters of nylon keeping you off the deck. And for me, I've got my arms and my feet.
Yeah, Conrad, where's your rope?
All of a sudden you catch up. I'm like, oh, my rope's up here. I feel comfortable with this stuff, so I can go up and down it.
I'm glad you feel comfortable.
As much fun as it is to climb, Conrad also has a serious stake in this icy landscape.
This chunk of ice is going to remain frozen until late March, early April here in Highlight Canyon, and then that chunk of ice melts, fills the reservoir, and then our community of Bozeman, Montana, gets its water sustenance from the ice that's trapped up here. Say if you're in India, if the Himalayas are losing glacial mass as fast as the scientists have observed, what's going to happen in 40 years when there's this reservoir of water in its solid state? What's going to happen when that is no longer present?
It was a question we both wanted to answer. We were particularly interested in the condition of the Gangotri Glacier in India, one of the largest in the Himalayas, a place Conrad had visited on a climb 5 years before. How much might it have changed in that time? And what did it mean for the people who live below it? Our taxi ride from the airport into Delhi offers a fleeting view of the capital megacity, a pulsing blend of ancient charm and modern sprawl, with a fast-growing population of 16 million people. The traffic is outrageous, even to someone who lives in New Jersey. The Indian government has taken some steps to cut down on air pollution, such as requiring buses and taxis in Delhi to run on cleaner-burning compressed natural gas. But it's still carbon dioxide coming out of those tailpipes, and that is a big part of what is changing the climate. Our first stop was to meet Lester Brown, who's president of the Earth Policy Institute. Brown also happened to be visiting Delhi that week. We caught up with him outside a hotel where he was on his way to meet with Indian officials to discuss the melting Himalayan glaciers and the effect global warming will have on the world's water supply and on food security.
So someone in North America watching this program that is in part about a glacier and a river half a world away from them, if something happens to the glacier, that actually possibly could affect what an American pays for food.
It not only possibly will affect, it will affect what Americans pay for food.
And inasmuch as the U.S. has all these national security, global security duties around the world, I'm hearing this issue of global warming connected to glaciers, connected to water, connected to the food supply, as really a national security issue.
It's more than that. It's a global security issue. The real threats to security for us and for the world are things like climate change and population growth and falling water tables. These are the trends that are going to shape our future. I mean, no question about that.
We also stopped by the office of Dr. Vandana Shiva, a physicist, author, and well-known environmentalist. She also grew up in the Himalayas, and we wanted to tap her knowledge of the area before we began our journey to the glacier.
Give us some advice. We're going to go up to Gangotri. Conrad is an expert in mountaineering. He understands how to read ice. But this is also a human story, isn't it?
It's a very, very human story because unlike some of the very distant glaciers you would climb in the Rockies or in Alps, this is a very heavily frequented and highly populated area. I have seen a very, very abundant mountain system be turned into a land where people are being evacuated. It's as if it's at war. It looks like a war zone. And even the Gangotri Glacier itself looks like a war zone as more and more of the glacier retreats and it leaves behind just this debris instead of the beautiful white snow.
Before we could see for ourselves, we needed to get one last briefing from Mandip Singh Soin, an esteemed mountaineer and outfitter of our trek, and glaciologist Syed Iqbal Hasnain, an expert on the Himalayas.
As a scientist, can you say that climate change, global warming, is having an impact on, for instance, the glacier that we're going to see?
Yes, it is having a big impact.
Dr. Hasnain recently visited a glacier in the western Himalayas that was already half gone, and most of the melting had taken place in the last 10 years.
So can you imagine what would happen if, let's say, this glacier that we're going to explore were to melt away? And then a river as important as the Ganges were to just flow during the rainy monsoon season, it would have a major effect on India.
Yeah, sure. It will take a while to melt out. But
he showed us how the ice is not only melting back, but the glacial mass is thinning out, breaking up, and becoming unstable.
It is really a scary scenario for North India.
There was also some free advice for our hike across the crumbling glacier.
Be careful about the big boulders which are sitting on your head. So don't talk much and just quietly track it.
Okay, let me just write that down. Don't talk much. Boulder could hit head.
Yeah.
Finally, it's time to pack up our gear and head to the Himalayan watershed. Our route follows the Upper Ganga Canal that was built in the 19th century by India's British rulers. The huge artificial waterway diverts some of the Ganges directly to Delhi from the holy city of Hardwar. The idea behind this enormous project was to supply irrigation to farmers in the plains and stave off famine in times of drought. But now those farmers depend heavily on irrigation, and since Delhi has been attracting 500,000 new residents every year, there's been pressure to use this water to quench the thirsty city instead of the crops. It's on the road to Hardwar that we get a close look at the old India, the one where two-thirds of the population depends on agriculture and where 25% survive on less than a dollar a day.
The Ganges is not just a river that has been able to supply what I would say is two-thirds of India, its water needs. But if you look at the map of population density and you look at how long these populations have existed, there's no other society that has farmed for as long as people in the Ganges Basin have farmed.
The Ganges is said to sustain more people than live in all of the European Union. But beyond its economic value, it is the river's relationship to people that makes it one of a kind. For starters, there are perhaps 800 million Hindus who consider this river sacred.
India as a civilization is based around the Ganges. Culturally and spiritually, when you're born, you get a drop of Ganga water in your mouth. When you die, one of the rituals is to put a drop of Ganga water. When people are cremated, the ashes are taken to the Ganges.
Hardwar is where the Ganges tumbles out of the Himalayas on its 1,500-mile journey to the Bay of Bengal. We have arrived just in time for the peak of the Hindu festival Ganga Dussehra, marking the day when the Ganges, or Ganga, came down to earth. The hair of the god, Shiva, cushioned the fall. Hindus believe that bathing in these holy waters will cleanse away sins, and hundreds of thousands crowd the riverside steps called ghats to take a dip. Others wait until dusk to send a leaf bowl of flower petals, incense, and prayers into the swirling current of an ageless river whose time may be running out. Now the special fun begins as our little expedition sets out on the narrow, winding road to the town of Gangotri, deep in a region of the Himalayas called the Garhwal. The scenery is spectacular, while the driving conditions are exciting. As we travel higher in the mountains, the Ganges unwinds from its main tributary, the Bhagirathi. The glacial runoff is thick with silt as it surges through the canyons. But this once wild river is being captured by hydroelectric dams in a constant quest for more power and water. And sometimes that silt causes problems.
As you will travel up to the Gangotri Glacier, you will see how in stretches the Ganga is already dry because of the dam building. Because the gift of the Ganga is no more seen as farming, as fertility, as water. The gift of the Ganga is now seen, even as it declines with climate change, as a few short years of energy.
Projects like the billion-dollar Terry Dam Complex aren't always popular, particularly among the thousands of villagers who have been displaced by the rising waters. Among that group is Bachan Singh, the 72-year-old patriarch of a family from the village of Cham, or should I say, former village. Mr. Singh raised cows and grew rice, wheat, and lentils here until the government forced everyone to move to higher ground. We sat down to talk outside the new house Mr. Singh built above the reservoir. He has been told he has to move again. So many people have been uprooted, he said.
Has the government offered you land in exchange?
They've given us land, he said, but it's far away from here. It makes no sense for me to stay there. I just don't feel it's home. Not enough water, too much water. The lives of people along the Ganges ebb and flow with its fortunes. As we make our way deeper into the mountains, we pass dozens of pilgrims traveling on foot to worship at the source of the Ganges, a lifelong ambition for many devout Hindus. The paved road ends at the festive little town of Gangotri that sprang up around the temple of the goddess Ganga.
My first touch of the Ganges silt.
The market is filled with religious keepsakes and vessels for capturing holy water from the river. Conrad and I stock up on some flasks for later. We're at more than 9,000 feet now, and we stay for 2 nights to get used to the altitude before the trek. The next morning, we track down a holy man who's been documenting the effects of climate change in these mountains. We find Swami Sudaranand in his cottage on the edge of town. In addition to being a guru, he is an avid mountaineer and an accomplished photographer who has captured images of the changing landscape in a stunning book of photographs. He's clicked a lot of shots in his time, which is why he's come to be known as the Clicking Swami. He's a cheerful guy, but a devout pessimist when it comes to the fate of the Ganges. He's convinced that the Gangotri Glacier has only 10 or 15 years before it melts away.
Swami, how have you seen the glaciers change from from when you first came here?
I came first 1959.
He tells us he's seen the glacier changing much faster since about 1982.
Now Ganga.
He hears a message from the sacred river, the need for help and protection. The river is dirty, maybe finished, he says.
You feel alone in this fight to preserve this area?
Alone fighting.
Well, I'm with you.
Yes,
I'm trying to help out.
Next morning, a few clouds are moving in as we start the 12-mile hike through the Gangotri National Park to the edge of the glacier.
Hello! Namaste!
This trail used to be clogged with pilgrims and tourists. Now, to cut down on trash, erosion, and poaching, the government has limited visitors to 150 per day. Old tea shops lie abandoned. The park is quiet, except for the river roaring below us, the chanting of sadhus, Hindu holy men, who come to worship here for months at a time, and the eerie sound of boulders tumbling under the swift-moving water. Our big goal is to reach the tip of the Gangotri Glacier, the place where the ice ends and the river of meltwater floods out of a cavernous hole in the glacier's base. That massive aperture is known as Gamuk, meaning cow's mouth, which is what the snout of ice looked like to early pilgrims. The wall of ice surrounding that hole has been melting farther upstream every year, and we're on the lookout for signs that mark this dangerous retreat.
Oh, check it out.
Our first Gamuk waypoint.
So the cow's mouth, the source of the Ganges, was here in 1891.
Think of that. Automobile hadn't been mass-produced at the point, and we were still living a pretty agrarian lifestyle in the United States.
The electrification had just begun in the United States, I think, around then.
We'll see these as we go up the trail to the actual Gamuk. And it's a really interesting way of seeing how far and how fast the glaciers retreated.
The source was right about here, but it's melted back. But that's not a surprise. I mean, you know, glaciers do retreat. It's not surprising that they retreat over 100 years. What we need to look for is whether or not it's speeding up.
Well, off to Gamuk.
It takes a whole lot longer to reach the face of the glacier and the mouth of the river than it did a century ago because it's melted back so far. We took GPS readings as we passed markers along the trail of the retreating ice. When we reached the 2002 waypoint, the brooding face of the Gangotri Glacier at long last revealed itself. There it is, a wall of ice hundreds of feet tall. To get an idea of the scale, look at these pilgrims, tiny specks in front of the massive glacier. See the wide mouth? Right there, the source of this river system.
The word is that a single drop of Ganges water at the source will make you live 100 years. Some say live another 100 years. I gotta get the drop. Sweet.
You can see how the leading edge of the glacier has collapsed into a pile of shattered ice. It's tough to make out the cow's mouth shape that earlier visitors had seen in the ice, but a mouth it is. Because there was a cave-in just the other day, the park rangers have warned us to keep a bit of distance. So we climb to the side of the mouth to take our final measurement.
This is pretty much even with the place where the water shoots out of the glacier. So I guess we could, like, mark this as where the cow's mouth is in summer 2008. So I'll drop a waypoint here. Just give me another second. I can tell you how far it's moved from 2002. All right, so it's just under a quarter of a mile. It's moved back since 2002.
In 6 years. And if we think back to 1891, the first waypoint, 117 years, and it went 1.1 mile. And now, a quarter mile in 6 years.
Here's what we found. The glacier was melting back 43 feet per year in the old days, speeding up to 67 feet per year more recently. Then, in just the last 6 years, we calculated the glacier has melted back a dramatic 175 feet per year. Not good news for all the people who need consistent water from up here. Not only is the length of this ice heap getting shorter, but scientists have data showing the Gangotri Glacier is also getting thinner. In just 25 years, climate scientists say all 18 miles and millions of tons of this glacier could be gone, like an ice cube on a stone patio on the 4th of July. We only have a few hours of daylight to traverse the glacier and climb almost 1,000 feet more up to our campsite. Unlike the pristine ice sheets of Antarctica, the debris-covered Gangotri Glacier looks more like a river of rocks. But as I crunch my way up the glacial moraine, it's clear that I'm walking on something that's alive and dynamic, even mysterious. Speaking of mysteries, I'm wondering where all the mountain peaks are. The weather's been closing in, and we arrive at our campsite as darkness falls, leaving me to wonder whether we'll ever get to see the spectacular scenery that Conrad has been promising. When day breaks, we find out where we've landed. We're in Tapovan Meadow at over 14,500 feet, and the clouds have pulled back to reveal fresh snow on a sky full of sacred mountains. The Bhagirathi Peaks at over 22,000 feet, Mighty Shivling at 21.5, higher than all of America's tall summits, and Meru, which Buddhists and Hindus believe is no less than the center of the universe. Since our mission is to explore the effects of climate change, Conrad decides to venture higher into the mountains to check on the health of the Meru Glacier, another important and endangered ice mass up here. While he's playing to his strength, climbing and assessing ice, I try to play to my own, interviewing one of the few human beings I can find up here.
I'm here to seek God, you know, peace and, peace, that's it.
This 51-year-old holy woman happens to have a master's degree in education from Northern Illinois State University. She felt a calling to climb up here 6 years ago to devote her life to worship. Now she lives in a cave and prays all day. Feeling a bit like a cliché from a New Yorker cartoon, I sat down to talk to her with a group of wild blue sheep looking on.
Whole universe is one family. They belong to one family.
We surely are one family when it comes to all of us dumping greenhouse gases into our shared atmosphere, I point out. She's surprised at the notion that Americans might give a hoot about the endangered glacier.
Why Americans should care about this glacier in India? Let Indians suffer, but still they're caring and they're covering in television, and that shows their heart.
She approved of what we're doing up here in her sacred mountains and hoped that the images we'd bring back home might show we're all in this together and maybe inspire some action to fix this mess. And while we're talking about activism, Conrad is scrambling on the Meru Glacier up at 17,000 feet, divining from the ice a parallel narrative.
In looking at this ice, we can see small pockets of air inside of that. There's the dirt on the surface, which accelerates the melting. This small pebble is melted into that little spot just today. So imagine, if you will, a glacier 30 square miles in size, covered with dark rock, getting the heat from the sun melting through.
Next day, before we start the long trek down, we sit for a moment to compare notes.
Interesting hanging out with you. You keep seeing it. Like, we'll see this absolutely gorgeous vista, this Mount Shivling, which is like the Matterhorn of Asia. And you'll look at it and go, not enough snow on that. Used to have more snow. Climate is changing. I mean, you see it everywhere.
Yeah, looking at it, and when we hiked up the Meru Glacier, we looked up onto the north face of Shivling. It's melting away, and to borrow a term from the medical profession, it looks anemic. They're just not healthy anymore. And when I got up there, looking down, you can see where it's moving. It was shocking to see how much water is melting out. What's happening to this? Why? What are the results of this? Yeah, they're gone, and we might not be able to climb it, but does this have an effect on our generation and generations into the future?
We were ending this leg of our journey and beginning another to look for some solutions that might pull our interconnected world back from what could be the brink of ecological and economic collapse. But Conrad and I had one more task to complete when we climbed back down to Gamukh, the source of the Ganges. An invigorating plunge into these frigid waters is supposed to wash away the sins of your ancestors. All right, but I myself have some things to atone for.
is coming out of a giant block of ice. The temperature, yeah, get the picture?
Including any carbon I've burned unnecessarily over the years. We fill our little flasks with the sweet glacial waters to share the benevolence of Mother Ganges with our families a world away. The trek down the mountain is easier on the lungs but harder on the knees. Along the way, we see more reminders of the hundreds of thousands of pilgrims who came before us. Sadly, too many visitors in previous years stripped the surrounding forests for firewood, leaving barren slopes. It's a loss these mountains can't afford, since trees not only protect and replenish the watershed, they help capture the carbon dioxide that's been linked to global warming. Things were looking a bit bleak, until we stopped at a small green oasis just off the trail. Dr. Harshvanti Bisht is an economist, environmentalist, and mountaineer who is trying to protect the glacier by reforesting the slopes around it. These seedlings will be transplanted when they're more mature.
That's very slow process. It's very cold area, then the soil condition is also not very good. So it takes a long time for a sapling to grow.
15 years ago, Dr. Bisht decided to give something back to the mountains she loves to climb by organizing volunteers to clean up trash and plant trees. It's hard to imagine that small projects like this brave little nursery at the headwaters of the Ganges might make a difference, but symbolism is important in this land of shrines and sadhus, and as we've learned from the pilgrims along the road, great journeys start with small steps in the right direction. Descending from the magical foothills of the Himalayas into the urban sprawl of Delhi is a visual reality check on the pace of this nation's economy. In Delhi and other megacities like Mumbai and Pune, new office buildings, apartments, and condos are rising. The global financial collapse has dampened some of India's development frenzy, but its economy is still predicted to grow by 5 or 6% in 2009. A rapidly expanding middle class of consumers want a lifestyle like their counterparts in America. That means new cars, TVs, and modern appliances. And who's going to begrudge them the things that we Americans already enjoy, recession or no recession? Even though the energy required to fuel this kind of consumption both here and in the West may end up raising the planet's temperature and throwing civilization dangerously out of whack.
You can't photograph rising CO2 levels. You can't even photograph CO2. But you can photograph glaciers and the ice melt and the irrigation systems.
And you can also photograph power plants. India gets more than half its power from the cheapest and most abundant means of generating electricity, burning coal. But coal-fired power plants produce more carbon dioxide emissions than any other energy source. China, which has a border with India only a few miles from the Gangotri Glacier and is just as dependent on a steady water supply, has also been in the throes of a furious economic expansion that requires an equally intense jolt of electricity. Neither country is keeping up with its energy demands. To maintain a high growth rate over the next 20 years, India may need 5 times the electricity it now produces. It plans to build huge coal-fired power plants to meet its energy needs. In 2008, China was putting at least one new plant online every week. Why do so many policymakers find this so alarming? Because during any given stretch that it's fired up, an average 500-megawatt coal-fired power plant pours the same amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as 500,000 cars, SUVs, and pickups. But even in the face of daunting numbers like these, there is a revolution of new thinking going on that does not accept that rising standards of living means wrecking the planet. Some of that thinking is right here in India. For instance, Dr. Shiva, the environmentalist, disputes the notion that rapid expansion based on fossil fuels is the right prescription for India and the rest of the developing world.
So what you really have is the fossil fuel economy crushing the living economy of India. The India that lives on biomass, the India that lives on the rivers, on free access to water, that India is being crushed.
Dr. Shiva promotes a revolutionary approach to rescue India from its cycle of famine and poverty, reduce the use of fossil fuels, go organic, cut out pesticides, artificial fertilizers, and sometimes water-intensive, genetically engineered crops. The monsoon rains were finally slashing through northern India, delivering their precious once-a-year dousing of moisture. And now Conrad and I were headed back to the United States to look at some of the solutions to the climate challenge taking shape in our own country. Back home, one change has to do with leadership at the very top. 2009, a new president in front of a new Congress with a new view on climate change and energy policy.
But to truly transform our economy, to protect our security and save our planet from the ravages of climate change, we need to ultimately make clean, renewable energy the profitable kind of energy. So I ask this Congress to send me legislation that places a market-based cap on carbon pollution and drives the production of more renewable energy in America. That's what we need.
But transforming words into action requires buy-in from across America. Can the United States summon the political will to make massive changes in the way energy is produced and used? We went looking for answers in Montana, a place where climate change right now is having an impact. In fact, it's easy to imagine Montana as a kind of developing nation within the United States. Behind the majestic scenery lies one of the poorest states in the country, but it's rich in untapped resources, including oil, gas, and coal. Montana has one of the largest coal-fired power plants in the West, here at Colstrip. And yet exploiting fossil fuels means contributing to global warming, which melts Montana's frozen water supply. The mountain ice that Conrad and I climbed on last winter is now pouring out of faucets in Bozeman, recharging the blue ribbon trout streams that draw fly fishing and tourist dollars to the region, and filling irrigation ditches in ranches like this one. It's been in Walt Sales' family for five generations.
This is a canal that my great-grandfather helped dig to prove up his homestead.
But the rhythm of the ranch has been disrupted by a changing climate. Sales raises cattle, grows hay, and leases land to a potato farmer. Montana has suffered a long stretch of drought in recent years, and it's been tough on ranchers in the Gallatin Valley. Just like farmers in the Ganges Basin, they rely on a gradually melting snowpack for a steady supply of water for irrigation through the growing season. For a decade, there's been too little snow in the mountains, and it's been melting earlier every spring.
If we keep moving and warming up earlier in the year, we're going to lose that late water that we are relying on with our potatoes. If we don't come up with ways to either grow our crops earlier, you know, and change with that climate change as it changes, or find other ways to, you know, to hold that water, but we're going to have to adjust somehow.
It's not just the farmers and ranchers who have to adjust as the consequences of global warming hit home. Coal companies have been promoting clean coal technology and what's called carbon sequestration, that is, storing the gas somewhere, perhaps underground. But the technology is in its early stages, and it's not clear how effective or how safe it'll be. And it's hard for even progressive leaders from America's energy belt to quit the carbon habit. Montana's governor, Brian Schweitzer, who gave the key energy speech at the 2008 Democratic National Convention, is pushing a mixed agenda. Investment in alternative energy without giving up on fossil fuels.
In Montana, we're investing in wind farms, and we're drilling the Bakken Formation, which is one of the most promising oil fields in America. We're pursuing coal gasification with carbon sequestration, and we're promoting greater energy efficiency in our homes and our offices.
Coal is still king in the Intermountain West, but perhaps not much longer. Two major coal energy projects in Montana have been abandoned in recent months, reflecting a national trend. Meanwhile, power from the clean wind has been taking off. Montana has a large wind farm at a place called Judith Gap. Another 50 wind power projects are being planned in this blustery state. But even if all of America embraced the wind, new coal plants planned outside the country could make up for any carbon saved in a blink of an eye. This is a key reason why the administration is also pushing for international solutions. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has already raised climate change issues in face-to-face meetings with Chinese officials. The U.S. is urging China to adopt clean energy solutions.
The interdependent world in which we live requires us to find new ways to collaborate and cooperate in the face of unprecedented global challenges.
That effort is expected to come to a head late this year at a global gathering in Copenhagen, Denmark, where a new climate treaty is in the works. We caught up with environmentalist Lester Brown in Washington after he had just returned from his own round of meetings with world leaders, including India and China.
It's ironic that the two countries in the world who are now planning to build most of the new coal-fired power plants, India and China, are the two countries whose food security will be most directly affected by the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau.
Fact is, right now, China is pumping out more carbon pollution than even the United States. India is still way behind, but its emissions are increasing.
It's clear if we stay with business as usual, keep building coal-fired power plants over the world, we're toast.
The Obama administration is a great fan of a worldwide market-based system called cap and trade to reward the operators of power plants that do a good job of controlling CO2 emissions. The system's been used in Europe for about 4 years with, it's got to be said, mixed results. But Obama's plan has already met stiff opposition from U.S. lawmakers, including some within his own party, who say that it will rattle the U.S. economy in a time of recession.
Well, on the one hand, it's better than nothing. I mean, so just having no environmental policy, you know, is the worst thing. That's where we've been.
Kenneth Rogoff has his own doubts about cap and trade. He's the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and now teaches at Harvard.
But I think most economists, I don't know how much more widespread it is, but at least my colleagues would favor having a tax on polluters of any sort.
The more greenhouse gases your power plant or factory spews out, the more cash you'd have to pay the government. This course of action has a name.
A carbon tax. We need the money. I mean, it's not like we're not looking for sources of revenue. We need to stop the pollution to slow it down. So, I mean, it's sort of a win-win situation at the moment. Maybe the financial crisis will give us an opportunity to do the right thing here. I have to say, over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet one-on-one with a lot of presidential candidates and leaders. And as soon as I say this, their face pales, and I'm not sure they listen to anything
further. Because they're good politicians. It's very tough politically to put out a carbon tax.
Exactly, because even though it's two sides of the same coin, if you're trying to control pollution, you have to give an economic disincentive to pollute. And there are two different ways to do it. And when you say the word tax, people don't like it.
But Ken, you're a person who spent a lot of time studying the magnitude, the depths of the current financial crisis. You're willing to advocate a pretty big tax, even at a time when the world is in such dire financial straits, when consumers are struggling?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to tax something because the government's running up these trillions of dollars of debt. Why not tax something we wish we were doing less of?
It's clear Americans will pay something to help the environment. Witness the renewed interest in electric cars and all the low-energy fluorescent light bulbs now sold. But how much more are people willing to pay if it comes to cap and trade or even a carbon tax? Not much is the betting in some quarters. Groups that oppose environmental regulations say the taxes to create an earth-friendly energy system would raise the cost of gasoline, electricity, and lots more. And note this ad, which ran in two big newspapers in recent weeks from the libertarian Cato Institute. Global warming may be real, but it's not a potential catastrophe. Quote, the case for alarm regarding climate change is grossly overstated. Indeed, in this time of economic crisis, public support for fighting global warming seems to be melting away. A poll by the Pew Center this year found that on the top 20 list of pressing priorities, climate change came in dead last.
In the months ahead, with the big Copenhagen Treaty in the works, there will be intense lobbying on both sides. An essential question is this: will America seize the moment to lead, or will our country once again walk away?
The world, for better or for worse, tends to follow the United States. I mean, the reason we have a lot of these problems today is because we have 6.5 billion people in the world, all of whom are dreaming the American dream. They want to live as we do, and so we see everyone emulating us. But if we begin to move from coal and oil to plug-in hybrids and wind energy and solar thermal power plants, the rest of the world will follow.
The Iceman cometh one more time, one last glacier in Conrad Anker's home state. Montana's Glacier National Park is a high-altitude wonderland and a big draw for adventurous tourists. But if you want to see a glacier in the lower 48, you better get up here before it's too late. Dan Fagry has run the numbers, and the prognosis, not good.
What's your best estimate as to when there'll be no glacier there?
Well, we think that the glaciers will be gone by the year 2020, or basically 12 years from now.
A dozen years.
A dozen years for glaciers that have been on this landscape for a minimum of 7,000 years continuously.
Fagry offered to take us on a hike up to one of the few glaciers we could still reach on foot.
This matters to this valley. This matters to the tourists coming up to visit. But why does it matter beyond this specific stretch of Montana?
What's happening here is happening all around the world. And so this is one more place, kind of a listening post on the pulse of the world, to say that, in fact, it's changing in fundamental ways. One glacier melting doesn't mean much, but thousands of glaciers melting simultaneously means there's something globally happening. It's a global signal.
I'm a layperson when it comes to glaciers. I come here, I appreciate them, I see the beauty in them, and I've come to realize how important they are. And I'm wondering, what can I do to make the glaciers last longer?
For most of the glaciers in the American West, unless something changes, they'll all disappear. And we can't do anything directly about that or bring them back. But I think that it becomes a compelling reason to start looking at human footprints on the planet and start, you know, as a larger society, figuring out how we're going to change things. So I think that's one of the beauties of the story about melting glaciers, is it gets people galvanized to begin this social debate about how do we deal with this future.
So do we simply mourn the fragile beauty of these lost glaciers? Or as Dr. Fagry suggests, do we learn a lesson from them? What is the story in the ice? Maybe it's as simple as the message the wise woman in the Himalayan meadow asked me to deliver, that we are all connected through air and ice and water and food, and that our fates are linked to the choices we make today. For more on glaciers, water, food, and global warming, as well as my personal journal of our trek into the Himalayas and an extended slideshow, check out our website. Connect to Now online at pbs.org. Are you losing track of all the efforts to fix the economic mess? Well, what's working and what's not? Check out our new Collective Wisdom online page, where you'll find the latest news, insightful reports and interviews, and resources related to the economic crisis from across public media. Connect to Now at pbs.org. On the next edition of Now, rape or sexual assault. In America, one of those crimes happens once every 2 minutes. Now investigates why in tens of thousands of cases across the country, DNA evidence collected by police has never been tested.
We had thousands of rape DNA kits sitting on shelves in freezer lockers.
And that's it for Now from above the Gangotri Glacier in India. I'm David Brancaccio. We'll see you next week.